Happy Monday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View Ask Dr. Goodman show. This is Melissa, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1, and we will cue you into the show. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 47,400 listeners, for tuning in. Dr. LaVon Goodman is back with us tonight on the HD View Ask Dr. Goodman show. Her knowledge and experience in testing and treating Huntington's disease is a valuable asset to our community. Dr. Goodman has graciously agreed to offer her expertise every first Monday of the month. So please let's take advantage of this time with her and get your questions together, either in the chat room or call into the show. We do have a guest tonight, guest caller, so I'm excited about that. Tonight we will be talking about predictive testing for Huntington's disease. Read Dr. Goodman's newest article, Predictive Testing for Huntington's Disease, on her website. That is www.hddrugworks.org. Hello, Dr. Goodman. How are you tonight?
Hi there. I'm good.
Hope
you were well,
too. It's great to have you back.
Thanks.
Appreciate you spending this time with us, and I hear you're in Florida right now.
I am.
That's fantastic. I wish you could meet up with James.
Yeah, next year maybe.
Okay.
Now that I know he's close to here, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's talk about predictive testing. In your article, you have some interesting stats relating to what is known about the consequences of testing. It's in your article, Predictive Testing for Huntington's Disease. And before we go into a question from the caller, do we know how many actually test? How many people actually test?
No. The closest I think that any study has come to has been British Columbia, where they have socialized medicine.
Right.
And a very wonderful HD center there in Vancouver. And they estimate, at least in British Columbia, where there's very good Huntington's care and follow-up, about 25%. Now, that's higher than it is, I believe, in the United States. But, you know, there's no way of knowing what the denominator. We may know how many test per year, but we don't know how many are at risk.
Right. Now, you have some stats. You have some stats on the consequences of testing, too. And I think before we go into all that, we do have a caller. And can we use your name, caller?
Yes.
Okay. Cheryl is
actually
from Washington. And she, let me just kind of set this up. She emailed me a while ago, a couple of days ago, and was having issues or wanting to know how to go about testing. And I'll let you, Cheryl, ask Dr. Goodman the question that you had sent me in the email. Go ahead.
Dr. Goodman, first of all, thank you for taking the time to listen to us. I'd like to find out what the international protocol is for testing minors and why it's so difficult to convince the community of doctors to test minors if the minors are capable of becoming sexually active and they're capable of making a decision on whether they're going to go into birth control and capable of making other decisions. And if it's truly their desire, why has that been found that it's more of a negative view versus a positive in embracing it?
The international guidelines say 18. Now, we all know that some people who are much more mature at 16 than they are, than others are at 21. It's an arbitrary number, and that's they chose a number that they thought would come closest to people being able to make a knowledgeable decision about testing for Huntington's. The guidelines, and remember these are guidelines, these are recommendations. That doesn't mean they have to be followed. These are recommendations. They are not rules that have to be followed. So in individual cases, it may be, for instance, if this minor truly wants to test, is adamant about testing, then the center might indeed consider that, or the person that she's going, or he, or I assume she, but whomever at age 17 would want to test, they would need to convince that the counselor that they were mature enough to deal with the answers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so easy, and there's nothing definite about 18. That's an arbitrary number. That most, but because it's a recommendation by the National Huntington's organization, they tend to follow it as a rule. But it's not written in law that it has to be that way.
So if it's a guideline.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. If it's a guideline and I have a 17-year-old that wants to be tested and is very adamant in that, what does she need to portray to Dr. Bird when she goes to see him tomorrow?
You know, I am not her physician, and I cannot speak for any of the physicians at any of the centers. Different doctors will handle things differently. I do not know what the counseling situation tomorrow at University of Washington, what they will decide, but I believe that he will have an open mind. That's my hope. And I'm not here to guide you through a process of what she should say, because she is the one who should be talking, and not you or not me. Or anyone else getting her into, you know, helping her with this decision. It has to be completely hers. And what the center does is really up to the center.
Okay.
So they, and some are more rigid than others. So I don't have a good answer. The answer will be how she and Dr. Bird come to a mutual decision.
Okay. And when was this protocol established? Do you know?
Oh, it's been, I don't know the exact year, but it has been for more than a decade. It has since the advent of having the test available. After the gene was found, having the test is now 11 years or so since the test was available. So it would have had to have been after that. And there's been a second iteration of it. So there's it's a big meeting or a meeting of the minds in a lot of European countries. And usually they have their meetings at the World Congress. And a couple of years ago in Vancouver, they did some updates on that based on new findings with how to interpret intermediate alleles, or alleles that you can't be sure that there's or there is uncertainty about whether there will be Huntington's disease or whether there is risk of passing it to your children. So there were new guidelines and recommendations helping to guide counselors on how to explain this to people. And that was maybe in Vancouver 3 years ago or so.
Can I ask a question? Now, you're saying counselors, so is it something that the centers are doing, they're having the person meet with the counselor first and then decide whether they want to test? Or is the test recommendation by the counselor or the doctor?
The doctor makes the decision whether or not to order the test. It's the doctor that has to order the test. Different centers have different follow a little bit different protocols. Now, if she were 18 and there wasn't that uncertainty, then she would probably, this visit would also be with a genetics counselor. In my article, I talk about, the first thing you do is you make a phone call and the process is explained to you. And how the visits fall are different from center to center. you may have genetic counseling from a counselor on the same day you see the doctor for the first time. Or they may be separate days, depending on how your center can get things scheduled. So I'm not giving you an absolute number because answer, because I think it varies a little bit from center to center.
Okay.
Yeah, we can have a sidebar discussion too, Cheryl, about this if you want.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's so many different variations, right, Dr. Goodman? I mean, each center is different. And apparently they're not mandated.
Each person who is testing is different.
Right.
So it's a unique situation, both the testing center or place where you're having this done and the person who's being tested or not tested. It's a unique situation.
Yes, very unique.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope we answered the questions that you have anyway.
It's uncertain. You know, we hate dealing with uncertainty. We would like to say yes or no and understand why it's absolutely yes or no. But there's uncertainty here, I think, in the situation where someone who's 17 really wants to know. Is there a good reason this person wants to know one year earlier? And I would try to find out, if I were the doctor talking with her, I'd try to find out why is this year so different than next year. If you're considering being sexually active, you should protect yourself from disease and also from conception. Whether you test positive or negative. So I'm going to suspect that the doctor there is going to ascertain whether there is a good enough reason why it has to be done this year as opposed to next. What would change?
Well, over the age of 18, there is no medical issue. The day that she turns 18 is the day that Medicaid stops. I happen to be the care provider of three of the children. My cousin died last year with it, and all of the rest of the ancestors with it.
Sure.
Okay. And
that's the reason. I mean, there are legitimate reasons for people for children under or young adults under 18 to be tested. And it would be, so this is something that you need to explore with the doctor there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and Cheryl, if you want to stay on and listen, you can.
Yes, I will.
Okay, great. And we can just mute you for right now unless you have another question or
no,
you come up with
fine.
Any other questions that you might have. But I appreciate you calling in, and I hope, you know, this was of some help. And if not, no, again, we can have sidebar discussions and discuss it further if you have any other questions or concerns. And enjoy the show and appreciate you calling in. Dr. Goodman, thank you for answering this question for us.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you. Okay, so we're talking about the consequences of testing. And in your article, you had some pretty interesting stats. Do you want to go over those, Dr. Goodman?
Sure. Now, remember, this is a study done with people in PREDICT and in Pharos. So these are two studies done at academic centers, and you're going to have these are people who have access to Huntington's care, have access to Huntington's experts, so probably in a better situation than that segment of the population who doesn't live near a center, who doesn't have expert medical care or expert medical advice. So you're getting probably, the cream of the crop.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is not that they're better than others, but they will have had more information.
Okay.
So you're getting the people who are probably better educated about Huntington's, know more about it, or at least they have access to learn it more, support
right.
structures with support groups, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So just remember who they're studying. It's always important
right.
when you try to interpret results.
They're pretty much already plugged into the system, so to speak.
Right, and so they have some level of support,
mm-hmm.
both at a doctor or a counselor, people at an academic center, they're in a study, and they more likely have greater support in terms of support groups and active chapters.
Mm-hmm.
The largest amount of discrimination happens if you belong to a Huntington family.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you have tested, whether you have tested positive or negative, the large share of discrimination, outside discrimination, is because you belong to a family.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a family who has the parent who develops the disease and symptoms early in life, well, then you're going to have more discrimination than if
mm-hmm.
your father or mother developed it very late in life, because you have more years to be discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
So that's to keep in mind as well. The study that they reported on, and there were five or six, probably even seven now, different variations describing the results of this study, where they looked at more than 400 people from PREDICT, and that included controls or siblings who had tested negative. It also included Pharaoh's participants who, at the time they entered the trial, had not tested. But this was done subsequent to Pharaoh's ending, where gene status or people had some of the people had developed symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But the Pharaoh's people had not tested. So you're going to have both people who are gene positive and gene negative, but they hadn't tested. So this was a mishmash of different participants in this study. And they broke it into various kinds of discrimination or stigma. And the one that happened most frequently was the personal one. So there would be social or relationship stigma from within or outside of the family. You know, your aunt decides that they're not quite as, that family isn't quite as close to you anymore. They're not going to have much to do with you. Or it can be a spouse, or it can be a parent or a sibling.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And remember, this is so a third of the people who were in this study said this happened to them once at least.
Mm-hmm. And don't you think that could be a consequence even before testing, too?
Indeed. You know, we haven't broken this up into, we know a lot of stigma or discrimination comes from just being in the family. So, and whether you've tested or not.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't separate from family stigma.
Right.
So what they did is they asked each person a bunch of survey, asked each person questions about, if they had any discrimination or stigma event. And then they gave examples of what it would be, what those things could be. And a third of people said, yes, they had experienced this in their lifetime. There had also been discrimination with medical or life or long-term insurance, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Quarter of, or a little over 25%. Others were denied jobs or fired or denied promotion, a smaller number. And then healthcare providers or legal issues, housing things, also present to a lesser degree. So it was mostly the personal and the insurance kind of discrimination, and then the cumulative burden, which means if you had any of those things.
Right.
So 50% or thereabouts said that, yes, they'd been discriminated against in one way or another or had some stigma shown to them. One of the things that they did not measure, which I think is important when you consider testing, is the stigma that's directed to self.
Yeah.
if, and that was not measured, and I actually think that's very important, if you feel a lesser individual for testing positive, if you feel that you are defective, you know, not that you are less than you would have been without testing positive, you know, that is a, that stigma too. It's harmful, and it's self-stigma is very. You lose your self-esteem just because you have the positive test. Then you give to Huntington's more, a lot more than it deserves, because you live your life differently,
right,
with less zeal or less happiness than you would have lived before developing symptoms if you hadn't tested.
Right.
And that's an important thing to consider. You know, I know, and I'm sure most of the audience out there knows, that some people do very well with testing, and some people don't.
Right.
And once you test, you can't take it back. It's something that you live with no matter how many years before you were to develop symptoms. So that is something that hasn't been measured, which is hard to measure, of course.
Yeah.
But it's something at least to pay attention to. I know I've had a couple of patients or people involved in some of the surveys and things that I've done that say, I wish I hadn't tested.
Yeah.
It would have been better if I hadn't have tested. But you will also have people like Charles Sabine and Jeff Carroll and who become wonderful advocates, mm-hmm. who become vocal, who are fulfilled by standing out there and getting Huntington's known about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Katie Mosier. And we can all think of people who, testing positive, they turned their lives into a more fulfilling life than it might have been otherwise. So there are two sides to the coin.
Right. Some people can't live positively afterward.
For some, it is more difficult.
Yeah.
And for some, it's a hard obstacle to get over. And I think a number of these people who do then stand up and, you know, on and become very vocal, don't do it right in the beginning. It's something they evolve into.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of testing, you know, I had received the email from Cheryl, and I was doing some research, as I usually always do before a show, and came across a document that was, I think it was dated 2003. It is the Huntington's Disease Genetic Testing Group, and I don't know if this particular guideline is still in effect or if it's been revised. I don't know. It was published February 2003. Martha Nance, Richard Myers, Alice Wexler, Andrea Zanko, Pat Allenson, Heidi Erickson, Elizabeth Gettig, Randy Jones, Elizabeth.
All very, very good people.
Creech.
Yeah.
Mark Nunes, Judith Sinsheimer, Kimberly Quaid, Sue Sobel, PhDs and medical professionals, that kind of thing, MDs. Do you know about that guideline?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Has it been revised since then, the 2002?
I think the only revision of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis was not included in the initial guidelines because it wasn't being done. You know, there, mm-hmm. the technology wasn't there. So mm-hmm. that is has been added.
Okay, so maybe I have the revised. Maybe it was published in 2001 and I have the revised, because I believe this one had included the IVF PGD procedure. But anyway, so I was looking through and I was noticing, okay, there are other clinical uses of the gene test, not just for predictive. Is that correct?
Of course. I mean, when there is increasingly with the new compassionate allowances, getting a gene test for diagnosis after someone has one symptom or another type of symptom, having that will help a person be able to get the disability benefits that are due them. Mm-hmm. So testing after symptoms, testing for diagnosis, if you have someone who's older or you don't know, or someone who has no family history, mm-hmm. and there are some symptoms that are concerning, then that test is done for diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different set of these guidelines then don't really apply,
right?
Because it's not predictive. Is that what
right.
you meant?
Well, okay. they have different confirmatory and diagnostic testing. They have predictive testing.
See, that is confirmatory testing. You mm-hmm. think this person has Huntington's, has symptoms, then you do the test to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may have someone who has no family history.
Right.
Or you may have someone who has lived to a more advanced age and has no family history.
So I guess what I'm really wanting to just kind of let our listeners know that these are guidelines, like Dr. Goodman mentioned, and they're not mandated to follow these guidelines, you know, 100%. I mean, it's really...
No.
Up to the
there are,
individual.
There are neurology physician offices who will do, you know, order a genetic test to their local site and not send someone to a testing center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are geographic barriers for people getting to every site, geographic ones that end up costing a fair amount, or there may be, you know, costing at a testing at a center is fairly expensive
mm-hmm.
Compared to testing in your neurologist's office. So there are, and I'm not saying that one is better than the other, but whatever, wherever one tests, they need to be, you need to be knowledgeable about what you need to be asking, what that person needs to know about Huntington's. You don't want someone who knows nothing about Huntington's testing
right.
you.
Right.
They won't be able to interpret the test for you. You want, if you're going to go through testing, then you want to, for heaven's sakes, get the correct interpretation.
Well, and you also want to have a sensitive physician who can counsel. If the physician's not part of a clinic or center or whatever, you want to have that physician be sensitive and you know, compassionate.
I think that sensitivity and empathy in physicians, you can have empathetic physicians outside of centers, and you can have non-empathetic physicians inside them.
Right. Dr. Goodman, we are getting a flurry of comments and questions, so I'd like to, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'd like to address
sure.
some of these questions that are coming in from the community. One of them, and we have a caller too, I think. James, do you want to bring on the caller first? Is it Marie?
Yes, we have Marie Clay with us.
Oh,
Marie, you're live with Dr. Goodman and Melissa.
Hi, Marie. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thanks for calling
Hi,
in.
Hi, Melissa. Oh, I don't get a chance because I'm usually working, but I had
yeah.
an opportunity today, so I
well,
had to make sure I made a note of it.
This is a
well,
treat.
Hello. Good to hear you.
Okay. So do you have a question or comment?
Well, I've got a question. You know, I have a support group here in southeastern Virginia, you know, and our group is growing, which is good and bad, and it's like I'm able to reach out and help people and direct them to different places, but you know what? It's got something in my lap now, and I don't know how to handle something. My husband died of Huntington's, and I have two daughters. My oldest one has Huntington's. She's 40 years old. My youngest daughter, who's 38, it seems like in the past year, I'm noticing symptoms that look like Huntington's, and she's not easy to talk to about it. She battles back and forth whether or not to get tested. you know, it's really causing some havoc in the family because of the symptoms that I see in HD that I'm so familiar with, being the recluse, and, you know, they get something stuck and they won't let go of it, and they just beat that dead horse, and it just everything is pointing to symptoms, and she refuses to get any counseling. She doesn't think that, you know, counselors are any good. It's just a lot of negativity. So I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions on how to deal with somebody that in this type of situation.
Yeah, in this type of situation, you cannot force a person to test. That person has to go willingly, even if we, whether we're the physician or the family, believes it's in their best interest. It's in her best interest to have her symptoms treated, whether she tests or not. And I would work on that first. If there are some behavioral issues, I'm not saying it will work, but don't have testing hanging out there in front, because that probably is a barrier, a scary thing to her. But if you can convince her or get her thinking about that there are medicines that can help with some of her anxiety.
Yeah. I've tried that.
Depression.
Yeah, I've tried that, and she's just refusing. And we don't really talk about the testing anymore because it's a decision she has to make. She's an adult. But I've suggested the counseling. I've suggested just something to help her with her anxiety. And it's,
I suspect that's making the relationship worse.
It is.
Or not.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Well, when it starts making the relationship worse, I think that's a good time to back off.
Yeah, well, I'm doing that because it's stressing me out. Because, you know, I'm having to deal with my other daughter that has HD. Dealing with an elderly parent in another state that's having signs of dementia.
Well,
so I'm trying to have limited contact as much as possible. But
Well, you need to take care of yourself. If she's not going to allow you to help her, and the more you try, the worse it gets, you don't just step back, but you try to do some things to help yourself.
Whatever
those
things
are, that's easy to say. You have no time to do that, or energy probably, but
you can't fix everything. In the whole family.
Right. Perhaps there are other family members who can step up to the plate to help her too. Don't try to take it on all by yourself. These are the impossible situations. These are situations where there's absolutely nothing you can do until the crisis happens.
Yeah, I mean...
Marie, can I ask you a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Are you the only one that really can manage the situation? Is there a partner or a co-facilitator that might be able to help you?
There's nobody else. I can't say anything to her husband because everybody gets defensive. Some people are just blind to things, don't want to rock the boat. She's caused havoc with other family members, so nobody wants to be bothered, you know. So I'm, you know, she's telling me things that it really frightened me, and that causes me concern.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just, like I said, you know, I can direct people in the support group for, and it's like, you know, here I am, and I'm like, I have nothing, I have no clue what to do. And I tried all the things that you mentioned.
Is she suicidal?
I would say yes.
Okay, that's the problem. Dr. Goodman, what can we do about that if someone is suicidal?
Well, what is suicidal? That is something that needs to be addressed by a physician. You have to get her to the physician. If she is a threat to herself or to others, then police can be called. and she can be taken to an emergency room.
I think the only thing that keeps her going is her kids. I think that's the only thing that keeps her going, but I'm so afraid that one day she's just going to snap and that there's nothing going to be there to stop her that's going to make her realize.
You're kind of seeing the signs I hear in your voice.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Mm. Can you invite a professional to come be a speaker at your meeting and maybe have a sidebar with her?
Well, she lives in another state.
Oh, she's not at your...
She lives in another state, so that's an issue there in itself.
What you can do, if there is a social worker associated with one of the chapters, you can at least alert them that there is a potential problem. Now, they won't be able to do anything without that person wanting some help. But alerting people of the situation that you're concerned about, I mean, that's something you can do, but you cannot, that person on the other end, that social worker, can't reach out and contact that person without her permission.
Yeah, well, the hard thing is that she's becoming more and more of a recluse. She's no friend. I mean, I'm not stretching the truth on this. There's no friend. She's come off of Facebook. She said she's gone back on, but, you know, I don't know. Friendship is very limited. She doesn't like people. She told me that straight out. I don't like people. So that's why my concerns are growing more and more with every conversation I have with her.
Right. I mean, your concerns are legitimate, but there are a limited number of things that you can do. Actually do until it reaches the stage where it is legal to do intervention.
Well, I guess I just have to wait for that shoe to drop.
That is, that's a big dilemma for many patient situations like this. You know something needs to be done, but your hands are tied.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that's going through this.
I understand. The family is. This is a the whole family is. And then you fight amongst, or fight is the wrong word, or maybe it isn't, amongst each other about what the best thing to do is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to reach a certain point where the system will kick in.
Are you concerned that she will be institutionalized or?
No, I guess it's with me not being there to actually see some things that's making me uncomfortable. And I plan on being there in March for about 10 days. I'm going to get a better view of things there. I'm just hoping that everything doesn't get volatile while I'm there. It's hard when you're not there to actually see, to get a full grasp of things. And, I mean, I've noticed when I was there last June, I noticed some things. And, you know, I just kind of just let them, you know, didn't really say much. But since June, you know, just all telephone conversations and things that are happening, I'm seeing more and more things that I see with other people with Huntington's.
Right, but you can't intervene until she or family members there wish you to.
She seems to feel that I don't care. That's what she told me. She says, you don't care. And I'm like, you know, how? I mean, why would I not care? I've lost your dad. Your sister's got this. You're the only one I have left. Why would I not care? So I'm like, what more can I do to show her that I care? I'm here. I talk to her.
You can continue to tell her that you care. I mean, you are caring. You are caring. You care. And that's not something that you should question in yourself.
Yeah.
It's just that there are things that you can't do to help her, but you care.
I think it bothers her because I've learned that I've got to take care of myself and I do the things that I need to take care of myself. And I the support group keeps me going. That's how I cope. And I think she thinks that I'm just too involved with things and that I'm not caring about her. So I just
maybe it's time to go see her.
Yeah.
I mean, that's risky, but maybe
well,
it
I'm
is.
Well, I'm going there in March. Yeah, I'll be there in March.
That's good. You'll be able to get a feel for where everything is at when you go. And Maria, I just want to tell you.
It's been about 8 months.
Yeah, I just want to tell you that there are many people in the chat room who are saying they understand what you're going through. Many other people are going through the same thing, and you're courageous for coming, you know, on the show and expressing
your concern.
I
just thought there's probably other people probably dealing with something I'm going through. With,
yeah,
you know,
yes, many of us. Many of us.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I just wanted to, you know, be open about it. And I appreciate, you know, what the input that you're giving me. I really do. And I'm glad I was off today so I can listen to the show.
I'm so glad you're able to pop on with us. And I hope
thanks
you
very
can
much.
Get things a little situated when you visit in March.
Okay. Well, thank you both.
Thank you, Marie.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate your call and your concern.
Well, thank you, James.
Yeah, and the people in the chat room are just, people in the chat room are pretty supportive too, right, James?
Yes, absolutely. So many people are going through the same thing. It's just very difficult.
Yeah.
It's hard when families are separated by miles, you know, because the caregiver can't be in two places at one time.
Right.
Yeah, oh, yeah, you're right. And, you know, and plus I work full-time, so it's like, you know, what more does everybody expect of me, you know?
You need a clone.
So.
We need clones of ourselves.
I don't think Will can handle two of me.
Well, thank you for calling.
We're doing the best we can.
Yes. Well, thank you again. Y'all have a nice evening.
Thank you, Marie. Take care.
Bye.
Gosh, very familiar circumstance. I've heard it many, many times. James, did you have any other questions in the chat room?
No, everyone was just basically sympathizing and empathizing because I don't think there's any of us going through it or have gone through it.
Yeah. We did have one other question that came in before the show, and what I try to do before each show is put it out there. Dr. Ginman's going to be on. Get your questions together, and they're starting to do it, which is great. We want to have as many questions for Dr. Goodman while she's on. We only get her once a month. So this one is from Marie. I don't know if it's the same Marie, but she says, I've been to my center of excellence for my daughter who's showing symptoms of JHD. Probably not. She doesn't have full-blown chorea, but there are movements, and her emotional state has gotten worse. What I don't get is that they told me they won't test her because she's 14. I am her mother, and should that not be my decision to test her? My entire family supports my decision, especially after I just lost my husband from this disease. I might as well go to my primary care physician because I've heard on Facebook that many are going that route.
I think it's fair to say that the physicians at the centers tend to test a little too late, as opposed to the parents who might test a little too early, you know, and that is the, I mean, in general, and I'm not saying that, for this particular person who asked the question, but in general, and there is often some ill feeling, some hurt feelings about, you know, finally a parent goes in to have this looked at, and then we go home not saying that, no, we shouldn't test yet, or that's what the expert is saying. And I think the expert tests only when they're sure that they see signs.
Right, but they only see them for 5 minutes.
I understand.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you the way it is. Mm-hmm. They see a snapshot of the child, and they don't live with the child.
Right.
However, they are very cautious. They have to, you know, prove to themselves before they order this test that there is a high likelihood, very high likelihood, that these are symptoms of Huntington's. One of the reasons, and I'm not going to say whether it's right or wrong. I'm probably somewhere in the middle, but each center is a little bit different. I know I have sent a youngster for testing where they were a little concerned whether they should be testing or not, but did, probably, perhaps, anyway, based on my recommendation. But and this child did have juvenile, but I haven't seen as many juveniles as this expert has, so would defer to his opinion, I think. But where was I going? If you test someone, a child, you can either have a negative result, it's not from Huntington's, because many symptoms that we could say were Huntington's also occur in children that don't have Huntington's. The ADHD-like symptoms, the failing to thrive at school or progress at school, these depression or anxiety, this can happen without there being a positive gene. So you can get a negative test, that's good. You can get a positive test that says, yes, there is juvenile based on the number of CAG repeats, but you can also, and this is what the experts worry most about, get a positive test on a child that is much more likely to develop the disease in adulthood.
Right.
And this is the one that they are most concerned about. You know, how is that, and of course there's no answer for this, how is that child handled? Will that child be handled differently if it's known that they're going to develop Huntington's in adulthood? Will the parent treat them differently? Will the child be able to handle this as a child, knowing he's going to get it as an adult if he learns? So it's a quagmire.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the physician really wants to be convinced that child has symptoms. And I think that they probably are more conservative than they ought to be because they want to be sure. Does that make any sense? Now, the downside of not testing early enough is that benefits that you might be able to get for this child, you lose.
Mm-hmm.
Although you will get them in retrospect. It will catch up. Although mm-hmm. you won't have them right then. And you also, if your child is failing to progress academically, you may be pushing that child, which would be not a good thing if the child has Huntington's and can't learn on the same curve as his class, then you're not doing that child a service. Mm-hmm. So there's no perfect answer here.
I know.
So hard. It is a hard one, and
wow.
I'm kind of telling you both sides.
And listening to what you're saying and listening to the pleas and the cries from the community is that you just have to go with your gut. And, you know, if your child or loved one is you think they're, you know, you're seeing something going on, symptoms, there's a history, you know, go to your doctor and express your concerns and work it out with your doctor, whether it's a center of excellence or your primary care doctor. I mean, I don't think that you have to go to a center of excellence to be diagnosed, do you?
No, I don't. But
yeah.
It is imperative that you educate yourself and you make sure that that doctor knows how to interpret things.
Mm-hmm. Listen, we have a bunch of activity again, so let me back up here and see. We have, Harlan Khan. Hi, Harlan. Say hello to Teresa. Thank you for calling in to the show. Okay, he has a question or a comment. It seems her brain can't control her body temperature. Is this common?
Now, we're talking about someone who has Huntington's symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, then there is that is one of the symptoms of Huntington's, that there is not good temperature control.
Mm-hmm.
A person may feel cold all the time, or a person, it may be the opposite, that they may feel hot all the time. So there is impairment of the center in the brain that regulates temperature.
Right, and Harlan Jimbo has that too. I know exactly what you're talking about. Same with olfactory senses. The smells can just make him violently ill. I don't know if you have that issue, but anyway, definitely. And Judy Robertson. Hi, Judy. I can't see the chat room, so I'm glad that James is putting your names up so I can see you. And we have another chat that's up. To LaVon, instead of outright testing, can an MRI be done first, which shows brain changes, 10-plus years before onset? If the MRI shows changes, then the MD can order the blood test?
Routine MRIs that are done at regular medical centers will not, you will not be able to make a diagnosis of Huntington's until there's advanced disease. The research MRIs that are done are different. They image a more finely tuned part of the brain that's involved in Huntington's, and you're not going to see. In other words, no, unless the you're not going to see anything pre-symptomatically in a standard medical MRI.
Unless
that's
it's
different
from
a research one.
Right. They check the neurochemicals and all that, right, in the research ones.
Yes. And they image different they can image metabolic things with an MRI. They can image white matter change and not just gray matter change. So those are fancy research ones, which would not be done in your usual radiology department.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be helpful, no.
Good to know. Okay, Deb Madden went through the same thing with her daughter. Her dad was diagnosed in his late 30s. Her daughter's dad was diagnosed in his late 30s. Her daughter, since age 12, wanted to be tested. Apparently Johns Hopkins refused, and we had to wait until she was 18. So I think there's a lot of issues with centers or specific clinics that are refusing to test.
I think there are a lot of issues for the reason I said.
Mm-hmm.
The physician wants to be sure. Now, does the parent see that? You know, I'm on the side of the parent too, because
yeah.
I know that they, and you know, for a long time, the experts didn't believe that families could see things a lot before they could, and now they're,
right.
they're at least in the adult population, they're acknowledging that now. They know that we do, that it is there. Yes, it is. Families were right, but it hasn't extended down to children. Their actions. And I can hear the frustration, and I think it's a legitimate frustration, and
yep.
one that should be, there should be a continuing discussion. I know at the last HDSA meeting there was such a discussion, and pretty much the same thing is coming up as is here. Parents want to test earlier, and physicians say no.
Yeah. Now, will they change the guidelines?
I doubt it.
Because, okay, here's one of the things I did happen to read in this clinical uses of the gene test, and it stated that the use of the HD gene test in a patient whose symptoms are not typical of HD, and then they list such as pain, fatigue, unilateral neurologic signs, isolated depression, or non-neurologic symptoms. I mean, my son has pain, fatigue, isolated depression, are these not symptoms of HD?
Pain is usually not. Fatigue, yes. But fatigue is a symptom of many, many things.
Heard so many of the community members. I've gotten messages, phone calls, and lots of people
we're
talking about
pain in the predictive. We're not talking about pain in people who are symptomatic.
This is for diagnosing.
It is for in the person who doesn't have the typical Huntington's symptoms
uh-huh.
or pre-manifest or whatever word before typical symptoms develop, pain would be unusual. It would be atypical. That's what they mean by an atypical presentation.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Oh.
It means that it's very unusual. Pain is certainly a symptom of people after symptoms develop.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking solely about before motor symptoms or the other symptoms that can be used for diagnosing Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
Now, atypical doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. It means that it's unusual and rare that it happened.
Hmm. I guess I'm just hearing a lot of people telling me these things, and it doesn't seem that it's rare. So, I don't know. Weird.
It is not rare in the people who are symptomatic.
Uh-huh.
When I say rare, it means they looked at hundreds of people, and only a couple of them will have pain. And that's something that's called an atypical presentation. Now, if you had 25% of them who had pain, then it wouldn't be so atypical. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's how they I'm just saying the description, the medical, how they interpret that medical term.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know. A lot of information. And everybody's different, right?
Yeah, and you have to remember that there are a lot of things that aren't known about Huntington's that nobody knows. And, of course, there are a lot of things about Huntington's that an individual doctor doesn't know.
True.
So there are a lot of unknowns.
Okay. So what should we do prior to taking a genetic test? So, for example, we're going to take the test tomorrow. We should be prepared.
Well, I would say you think about
way,
this before you're going to take
right?
it tomorrow. Yeah. And that you shouldn't choose a time when you're at a low point in your life.
Right.
You know, not right after someone has died or just after learning that you're at risk for Huntington's. You need some time to think about that. And if there are symptoms of depression or anxiety or whatever, those should be taken care of first before a test. So if I have someone who comes in to me for counseling and they're depressed, I say, we really need to treat this depression first.
Right.
So whatever the test is, that you will have a much better chance of coping with it better. That would be a reason for me and other doctors, I believe, to say not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be coerced by anybody else. This should be your individual decision. And just like not doing Huntington's alone, don't do testing alone.
Right.
Now, many centers require a partner to come, and some may not. It's encouraged. Some people want to be private. And if I were convinced that this person had had a support structure and had things in place, then would I insist that a person come along? No, probably not, but it sure is better than not. Having another person to support you, you know, we need people when things are this big.
What if they want to be anonymous? Can they do anonymous testing?
Some centers will, some centers won't. I do it. There are different ways of being anonymous. You can not submit the bill to your insurance. You're not completely anonymous because, you know, the doctor knows, the person who does the lab test knows, and maybe they will know you. Now, can you use another name and pay for the test as long as your doctor knows? Yes. But if you were to have a positive test and then needed it for some sort of disability, then we need to do it again.
Right.
So, I mean, there are little tricks you can do, particularly if you're going to pay out of pocket for it, to improve your anonymity. But some centers won't do that, have a test done that they can't attach to a chart.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
As much as possible, have some things in place in your life, like medical insurance, long-term care, life insurance. If those things, if you can, mm-hmm. get those in place. It used to be that we said to do that for sure, but nowadays, if you have, with the policies now, they do ask about genetic things. So even if you haven't tested, they may ask you about genetic disease. Not something that they were asking in life insurance policies of a generation ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it may not be, so it's, even if you do try to do some of these things ahead of time, you may not be able to.
Does the Gene Act protect folks from that, or?
The GINA protects people from genetic discrimination for hiring or jobs. You can't be fired because of your genetic testing. You can't lose your health insurance either. And so there are certain things that GINA protects. It does not protect. It does not protect for discrimination for long-term insurance, long-term care insurance, or for life insurance. So GINA is partly protective,
mm-hmm.
but not for some of those things.
I know there are some long-term care policies that are not asking, but I think they're eventually going to go away because
I think there are fewer and fewer.
Yeah. And is there a time period? I think Judy's asking or making a comment here again. Hold on. I did have an email from her a few days ago, and she says, yes, bring somebody with you for the process. Insurances get beforehand, such as long-term care, disability, life insurance, and some of those policies require a period of time, example 2 years, that a person has to have the policy before getting a diagnosis, such as cancer, for instance.
Right. And I'm saying increasingly, just like you're saying, policies will ask about
yes.
family history.
Yeah. And then Judy also comments, perhaps the pain symptoms should be surveyed. My husband had terrible pain in feet, hands, shoulders before going to the neurologist who thought he had MS, and that was before the gene test was available. He later tested positive for HD.
Right. I can only say that, you know, based yeah. on what evidence base there is out there, I believe that it's not seen I suspect that Judy's husband was symptomatic, or he wouldn't have been going to a neurologist.
Right.
He was symptomatic with something. My comments were for the pre-symptomatic
mm-hmm.
folks in terms of pain.
Addictive.
Not for people who have already developed symptoms.
Right.
I do believe that there is, and I don't know what the fraction is, and is she right? Should it be looked at better? Because so we're flying by the seat of our pants.
You're breaking up.
Documented. Okay.
Are
we're
there?
Flying by the seat. Are you there now? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Okay.
Are you in the air?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were flying somewhere.
on my cell phone, I probably removed my mouth into a different direction.
Okay. Jim Rice. Hi, Jim. During my test in 2008, it was required that I bring my whole family.
I don't think that's the case anymore.
Wow. Good to know. Huh. Everybody's different. Okay, now what about genetic counseling?
I'm sorry?
What about genetic counseling? Do all the centers have genetic counseling?
I believe so. I think they're required to have access to it at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, what is genetic counseling? It's going over the same sorts of things that we've been talking about this hour. Mm-hmm. And to let people know what the test the test may be able to say whether you're having will have Huntington's or not, but it will not be able to tell you when you will develop it. So the counselors need to tell people what the test will tell them and also what it won't. It won't answer all questions. So, you know, what we've done here today is actually a bit of genetic counseling. We've explained the risks, the benefits of, you know, what you should look for, who you should have with you. And then you also need to let people know that there may, at the end of the day, they may have an uncertain result with one of these intermediate numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not just be yes or no, it may be maybe. And have that explained as well. So what we've done today is kind of like genetic counseling. It's an education, and it's also you learn about that person and their support structure, their family history, you know, how, and you try to predict how this person will react to the test based on the things that you have seen with the patient, whether, you know, their strengths, weaknesses, or their family support. And I have the benefit of usually taking care of family, so I know that.
Yeah.
So that's...
We're kind of losing you again. Are you there? Hello, Dr. Goodman.
Yes.
Okay, good. You're kind of going in and out, so I thought maybe I lost
I'm
you.
I'm sorry. Okay.
That's okay. Okay, so let's kind of wrap this up. We talked a little bit about the process, the genetic counseling. What else happens before you test? Is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
Well,
the process.
Sometimes a psychologist test or interview is required. A number of places do not require that, or a counseling that is required.
And then cost. We could talk about the cost a little bit.
In the U.S., it probably ranges from $1,500 to $2,000 plus, and that includes the cost of the gene test, which is about $200 or $300, somewhere in between. Some insurances will pay for this, some will not. If you don't want it on your insurance company's letterhead, then you will want to pay for it yourself. And that can be prohibitive to many people. If you do this through a local physician, it is, of course, less expensive. But then you take on more responsibility yourself if that physician is not knowledgeable. Don't hear me saying that you should go to your local doc and get this done because it costs less. You need counseling and you need education. You do some of these things yourself, educate yourself, yeah. Can you be counseled by a physician who knows about Huntington's? Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't think one has to be necessarily rigid, but there are not a lot of doctors out there who know a lot about Huntington's who aren't in Huntington centers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we do have a chat room comment. Even with a negative result, there can be issues such as survivor's guilt that arise. So preparing for the test and undergoing genetic counseling to prepare for any possible result is highly suggested.
Right.
Good comment.
Indeed. And one of the things in the article is that what you try to do is envision what your response will be. If it's a positive test or a negative test. And I've seen very deep depressions in people who have tested negative.
Yes.
So, yes, and I thank that person for pointing that out.
Yes.
So we wouldn't forget it. Yes.
Well, it's an excellent article. You can find it at www.hddrugworks.org. It's the first article up there. And Dr. Goodman, thank you so much for coming on the show and for spending this time with us. I'm going to wrap it up now.
And I thank our listeners.
Yeah, thank you to the listeners out there for tuning in. Did you have anything else that we forgot that you wanted to mention? I always like to do that. Have you Did you want to make any other comments, Dr. Goodman?
No.
Okay.
You've heard enough.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Thanks for the call-ins. Appreciate your participation, and we really do value all of your comments and your questions and your concerns. It just makes it enriches our community to come together and talk about these issues. They're so important to us. And I'd also like to mention that I'm still doing the telemedicine survey. Please go to www.research4hd.org/telemedicine. Please take the survey if you haven't. I'm trying to get back to Drs. Biglin and Dr. Dorsey with this information. They're trying to put together a telemedicine program for our HD community. They are successfully doing it with a Parkinson's community. And I think it would just be a fabulous opportunity for us to have expert care in the home, or at the least have our primary doctors consult with the experts. Excellent opportunity for us. Again, Dr. Goodman, thank you so much for coming on the show and for devoting this time to us. We love you and appreciate you so much. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. And don't forget to contact me, helpforhd-international.org. Find us on Facebook. Get the free app on the road, Help for HD. It's free. Also available on the app is the original mobile connection to education resources and information about JHD and HD. Good night, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next Monday.